Hello everybody, my name is On, and this is On the Gad Talk for Thursday, 12th of October 2023. In this week's episode, we've got plenty of things to talk about. The PS5 Slim has just dropped, so is other devices, including new foldables. Plus, we got more details about the OnePlus 12 and the Galaxy S24. Next year's is flagships, and we're hearing more details about it now. So, and this and much, much more. So, without further ado, let's get rolling, shall we? Alright, before we start, I quickly want to observe a moment of silence for all those affected in Palestine this week, especially in Gaza, and all that's kind of been happening, again, with all due respect. Alright, this past week has been extraordinary, and a lot has really happened, and unsurprisingly, beyond all, other than what's really been happening in the news, it's kind of been a highly uneventful week. The Pixel 8 and 8 Pro reviews have dropped, and a lot of people have talked about how the cameras are pretty good, and that what this is what makes the Pixels good. And but also have sort of also touched on upon the fact that the Tensor G3 has sort of slowed down and stuff like that. But the first new gadget of the week, because we're in Techtober, pretty much is the PS5 Slim. Now this kind of came out of left field, more or less, because Sony has finally managed to start supplying more PS5s and also starting to sort of, you know, get competitive with the price, because they've had supply chain shortages for the past 3 years, two years after launch. They still had supply chain issues with the PS5, and you had to like wait in a line and sort of, you know, reserve a PS5 so you can buy the original without having to rely on scalpers and the like. But now we have the Slim, and basically the way they're sort of naming or marketing it is it's basically the second variant of the PS5. It's basically the PlayStation 5, not the Slim. But for simplicity's sake, we're gonna refer to it as the Slim because it's a new revision. And you know, if you love PlayStation or are kind of a fanboy, the mid-cycle upgrades of the PlayStation are really the Slim, frankly. So for simplicity's sake, we're going to call it the PS5 Slim. So there's a digital and disc version of the Slim, and pardon me, the PS5 Slim, it has 30% reduced volume, 18% and 24% lighter roughly in weight compared to the original. So 18% for the disc version and the 24% for the digital version, that is. And now it has a slightly different design from the original, given that it's 30% less volume, so it's a little smaller, sort of a slightly shrinked in looks. And also there's like a slit that sort of cuts on the sides of the PS5, where the original was like a continuous panel on either side. And what you get pretty much is four different cover panels. The top is glossy, the bottom is matte, so that's all you need to know really about the Slim. Oh, another one is that the PS5 Slim, there is a disc version of it and also a digital version, and you can now buy an attachable Ultra HD Blu-ray disc drive if you have a digital version of the PS5. It will cost you a fair bit, I will warn you. The disc drive you can buy separately if you have the digital version will set you back $80 or 100 British pounds if you want to play discs on your PlayStation 5 digital version, that is. But if you get the disc version, it slightly ends up being cheaper overall. In terms of pricing, before we sort of move on, the PS5 Slim will start at roughly $450 US, and the disc version, that is with a disc drive, will cost $500. That's the same price as the original disc drive PS5. And in Europe, it's roughly 550 euros for the disc version, 450 euros for the digital version. In the UK, it'll start at £480 for the disc version and 390 quid for the digital discless version. But yeah, as I said, you'll have to pay $80 extra if you want a disc drive. If you get the digital version, that is. It's kind of a deal breaker for some. But if you're like planning to buy the PlayStation 5 Slim in one go, and you don't want to run out and, you know, make an upgrade or run out and do a tweak down the road in the future, The disc version is a better deal at $500 roughly, whereas the discless version, you'll have to pay $80 for the di for to get a disc drive connected to the digital version PS5 Slim. So that's something to think about, pretty much. Oh, another one I want to add on top of the fact that you can add a disc drive to the digital version now for the Slim, 1 terabyte of storage. In both variants, up from 825 gigabytes. That's on the original. So you got 800-ish gigabytes to use, and you ran out of it fairly quickly. And you had to obviously switch out the get additional M.2 storage. But now you have a 1 terabyte SSD out of the gate on both variants, which is fine, but again, too little, too late, because again, rivaling. Well, let's talk about Xbox, pretty much. Xbox, on the other hand, offers 500 gigabytes base storage for the Series S, and the Series X already comes with 1 terabyte of base storage. So, and also the leaked mid-cycle upgrade for the Series X eventually will come with 2 terabytes of storage built in versus 1 terabyte for this one. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And if you think about it, it's basically, well, if you think about it, it's the original PlayStation 5, same processor, same horsepower, same performance, but for a digital version, you can now get a disk drive separately. The disk version, both of them are slightly smaller, 30% less in volume generally, but they're still mighty consoles. If you are into your FIFA or EA Games FC and your FPSs and some of the PlayStation first party titles, it's a pretty good buy. But as I said, if you can get the original PlayStation 5 while it's already available, I'd recommend that at the moment. The disc version would be a better deal because it's on discounts and it's identical. So, unlike previous generations, I just don't understand the appeal for the PS5 Slim. Whereas previous generations, the Slim usually would have brought in some new features, some dramatic upgrades of the like, but it seems like we're not going to be getting a Pro PS5 fairly soon. Also, another thing I want to add, if you're going to be getting the Slim, is you'll only be getting a horizontal stand to keep it horizontal, like mount sort of horizontally upright. If you want to put it vertically properly, not like wobbly under your TV, you'll have to get a separate stand that will cost $30. So that's pretty interesting in a way. But as I said, I'll probably iterate my point again. Once again, if you can get the original PlayStation 5, which will still be around, but as I said, once it runs out of stock, it'll be discontinued right away. If you can get the original on discount, it's preferable for the moment. The Slim, on the other hand, is fine, but as I said, the digital version, again, I would probably, if you ask me, I would probably wait for the disc drive to go on sale and get a pretty hefty discount to justify. And also the digital version of the PS5 Slim going on sale also to justify doing that combination. But at that point, you can make a choice for yourself. If you really don't want a disc drive, you're dependent on a PSN and PlayStation Plus or PlayStation, what do you call it now? There's a premium version. I think it's still PlayStation Plus. Yeah, PlayStation Plus Premium. Again, to play lots of games. The digital version is a good idea, but if you want to play disc versions of games, but they're obviously far and few nowadays, that's also a good option. But yeah, if you re unless you really have to avoid the Slim for now, it'd probably be a good idea in the following year, in 2024, 2025. But right now, the original's still kind of available, and there are already discounts for the original, so I'd probably go for the original PS5. In a way, but again, the Slim is pretty good in a way. Hopefully, it does fix some of the thermal. It is a lot cooler, and it does run at full power. Although, as I said, again, it's basically identical. Hardware-wise, is identically the same as the original, so that's something to consider. But yeah, if you ask me personally, moving along really about what platform generally offers a better experience. In my own eye, if I really had to spend my own money and buy a games console tomorrow, it'd probably be either Xbox or Nintendo. I mean, Nintendo Switch, you just can't play Switch games on a PC or stream them from the internet. You'd have to get a Nintendo Switch to get the most out of it, really. And also, while you're sort of at it, Xbox kind of has sort of stolen the show really well. They've got lots of good games now, and they've bought Activision, and that really sway. But as I said, the kinds of games I'd play most of the time would probably be on Xbox while you're at it. But at the same time, I could also build a gaming PC, and this is the thing. This is the thing. I think if you really look at the big picture, Sony as a brand, PlayStation, it really transcends. It really is its own its own sort of powerhouse in gaming. I mean, its reach is far beyond all of the competition generally. It is a truly global player, but really the biggest, sort of the final boss, let's just say, to PlayStation in this case, if we really are putting game analogy here, and using analogy from, ironically really, from the world of gaming, the final boss in this matter is PC gaming and smartphone gaming. Like, think about it. I mean, the PS5 Slim is good for what it is, but at this point, you might as well get the iPhone 13 Pro. You could run out and buy an RG Ally or the Steam Deck, or you can build a gaming PC or spec out a good gaming laptop, letting you play lots of popular titles off it without any effort. So really, that's the thing about PlayStation. Like, a lot of people like to say that, oh, Xbox is better than PlayStation, PlayStation is better than Xbox, yada yada yada. I mean, I always have kept this view of mine that all these big platforms, really, Xbox, PlayStation, Nintendo, are all great in their own ways and have their own strengths and have their own audiences. And generally, PlayStation obviously tends to be like the kingpin sort of the console business. But now, really, it really is up against other new ways to play games. It's up against smartphones generally and PC gaming. And PC gaming really blew up since the PS4 era, generally. That's just my own take, honestly. So, really, the biggest competitor to the PS5 Slim, honestly, at this point, is a well-specced $800 gaming laptop. And, you know, a PC or a laptop lets you do a lot more than play games, also. You could work on it, you could justify it for studies, and so on and so forth. And a smartphone, really. Think about it. Your smartphone is becoming so powerful day by day. You can get an S23 or an iPhone 13. What are we on? 15. The iPhone 15 Pro. We're on the 15 Pro now, more or less. I mean, the 13 Pro is kind of an identical example in terms of price, but really the 15 Pro exists, and you can and the latest and they and Ubisoft ported the latest Assassin's Creed to it. Now it only work on the iPhone 15 Pro with the latest A series chip, but it's kind of there and it's happening, and we are seeing that competition happen. And also, the performance gap has really shrinked between consoles and, say, mobile gaming, if you include handhelds and smartphones generally. So that's just one thing to keep in mind. It is a bit of a rip-off, right? It is expensive. The Slim, when you compare it to the original, when it sort of is on sale, honestly. But as I said, I'd probably wait for a good sale or discount to get the PS5 generally, original or Slim, regardless. So it's something to keep in mind. But at that point, if you are have a lot, if you really have a lot of money, go get a gaming PC or a laptop, or even buy an RG Ally and just go for it. You know, you'll really have a lot more experiences on it compared to consoles, where you're kind of locked down. You have to use the whichever team, whether you're on Team Blue or Team Green, their respective storefronts and subscriptions and yada yada yada. Whereas with PCMR all the way, you can use it. You can, you know, buy games from the places you like and want to do business with. You can pick the subscriptions you want to run on. Heck, if you have a PC, you wouldn't need to get an Xbox, frankly. You can get Xbox Game Pass for the PC, and that does a lot of the tricks really well. That's just my own fanboyism here. I'm more of a PC person, fortunately enough. I mean, it makes sense, and also, I use my computer more than just for gaming. I could record a podcast like this one, and also, you know, work from it, do remote work, and so it's more justifiable as a purchase. You can do a lot more, and your money goes further here with a PC compared to a console. But of course, there is a demographic or market of people, consumers, who only see would want to buy a console where they just plug and play, you turn it on, put a disc, download a game, hit play, off you go. But at that point, streaming is sort of going to replace or really absorb that market. And speaking of streaming, Sony also sort of, like, also this past week announced that they're launching PS5 cloud streaming for members for folks who have PlayStation Plus Premium. So what you can do is you can get you can play selected PS5 titles from the PlayStation Plus Premium catalog. That includes games like Spider-Man Miles Morales, Horizon Forbidden West. So a lot of Sony's is like first-party games, and also some third-party titles that aren't that really hard to render in the cloud, along with game trials, so you could really try out games and it runs in the cloud without having to really download and run a demo, preferably. And also, if you have any of the following sort of digital titles that, as a member, that you own, like for example Dead Island 2 and Genshin Impact, you can stream that also from the cloud. So that's pretty cool in a way. And as I said, when it does roll, this is going to sort of roll out in a beta, and obviously when it does become fully available to all users, it'll probably not be available for all titles because it'll be very hardware intensive in the cloud to run sort of an instance of a more powerful game with a larger open world element. So not even GTA 6 will be you won't be able to stream GTA 6 at the moment, if GTA 6 comes out, that is, ever really, that is. But select titles you can stream in 4K and 1080p 60 frames a second with SDR and HDR support, enhanced audio. You can even take screenshots and record 3 minutes of video, which is pretty interesting. Too little too late when you compare it to Team Green, to compare it to Xbox. They already have had game streaming for a very long time, and it works on a much broader range of devices other than an actual Xbox console. You can stream games over onto your smart TV, your PC, your phone, whereas this will only be on your PlayStation 5. I just don't get the point of offering this. If they really expanded cloud streaming and offered it on smartphones and smart TVs, and even Sony Bravia TVs, mind you, everything, if they offered game streaming, and that's over PlayStation Plus Premium, and it's like on an app, and you, if you have a Sony Bravia TV exclusively, you can do that, and you can't do it on another TV, it would be a good selling point. You wouldn't have to buy a PlayStation console anymore to get access to this functionality. But yeah, it's only on the PlayStation 5, unfortunately. So take it what you will. It's a good idea. It's pretty good. Oh, and in case you're probably wondering, you need minimum 5 megabytes per second to stream over the cloud, and 38 megabytes per second, or megabits per second, mind you, Mbps, to stream in 4K. So if you are looking to do this, then, and also another point I want to add is it's only available in Japan, US, Canada, and most parts of Europe. So if you live, for example, live in Bahrain, you won't be able to have access to this unless you have your PlayStation account is in those respective markets. So that's pretty interesting in wait, again, too little too late, but as I said, and also they didn't really offer it on other devices other than the PS5, so it's an interesting feature, that is. Right, moving on from consoles, gaming, to smartphones, let's talk about a new foldable that has just kind of been released or announced. Honor showed off a new foldable, a sort of a notebook style foldable, sort of answer to the Z Fold 5. There is the V2 on the other hand, but that globally is like their answer to the Z Fold 5. I'm talking about the Magic VS2. New foldable, it's thinner and lighter. That's the thing you want to know about the VS2 in a way. It's got a 6.43 inch LTPO OLED hour display with a resolution of 1060 by 2376. Variable refresh rate as always, up to 120 hertz. Eye saving mode, sort of eye comfort mode available here, because all Honor phones kind of have emphasis on the eye comfort functionality, so it should be on the VS2 likewise. 20:9 aspect ratio, so it's like literally a normal phone experience on the one hand, but if you want a bigger screen to play games, consume content, take notes, or run sort of desktop apps and sort of do your accounting and stuff like that, or do your spreadsheets and stuff like that, there's a 7.9 inch LTPO OLED variable refresh rate, 120 hertz, 7.9 inch display with a resolution of 9.8:9, so nearly 10:9, so it's almost 4:3 roughly. It's pretty wide, so there's plenty of room for you to do all your productivity tasks on it. The in and out display also do HDR 10 plus, also a variable refresh rate, eye comfort, and so on and so forth. So that's pretty cool in a way. And also, both sort of on the inner and outer displays, there's also a 16 megapixel front-facing camera, which is kind of overkill, frankly. Another selfie camera on the inner display, but hey, it's a nice touch that Honor has. It's not those undercover cameras where it's kind of blurry when you use the one on the inside, so that's pretty cool in a way. The VS2 is, as I said, slightly slower than the V2 because it comes with the Snapdragon 8 Plus Gen 1 chip, 12 or 16 gigabytes of RAM, 256 or 512 gigabytes of storage, no 1 terabyte option for a device like this, which is kind of a bummer, frankly. So yeah, pretty good memory and processor options. In a way, it should be not as expensive as the V2 in retrospect. As for cameras, honestly, the last thing you think about a foldable is the camera. But if you want to sort of fold open your, really unfold your phone completely and use the main cameras as a as a ginormous selfie camera, which is a pretty good idea always, you get a 50 megapixel main camera on the back, 20 megapixel telephoto camera. And that also has 2.5x optical zoom and a 12 megapixel ultra wide lens. So a telephoto and ultra wide, so there's triple camera setup on the back. Along with that, you get a 5000 mAh power battery. It's sort of split in two, so around 2500 on both sides, so that adds up to 5000. Pretty practical if you think about it, more or less. And yeah, it comes with Android 13 and Magic OS 7.2, so you get split screen multitasking. You can run two apps at once. And you can even do free hovering. So the idea is you can sort of have two halves of the screen used for different apps. So again, for example, you can have YouTube running on the left, or and on the right, maybe WhatsApp if you're that clever. So it's pretty interesting in a way. But the best part about the Magic VS2. And it was quite obvious when you look when it sort of saw the processor choice, the choice of processor they had here, being the 8 Plus Gen 1, and the memory option here is the price. And well, let's just say it's cheaper than the V2. And if it does come out globally, it'll be a little cheaper than the Magic V2. The VS2 will be available starting for around 6,999 yuan renminbi. So that's about $1,000 for the base spec. And if you want more memory, so that's double storage and extra RAM, 16 gigabytes of RAM, which is a lot for a phone of its of this caliber, be prepared to pay over $50 extra, $150 extra, so that's 7,699 yuan RMB, so that's about $1,050 roughly. That's according to GSM Arena, by the way. So it's pretty cool. And again, comes in velvet black, glacier blue, and coral purple. So it's a pretty cool phone. You get a lot. You get the eye comfort. You get the variable refresh rate displays on both the inside and outside. You do get a little slower. Oh, and another point that I forgot to touch on, being a foldable, the hinge. You get a Luban, a titanium hinge, which means that it's not that heavy at just 229 grams. So it's one of the thinnest. It's one of the lightest foldable phones in the world, in a way. And it comes in a magnesium alloy frame, so when you combine a magnesium alloy frame and titanium hinge, it's only 229 grams, the lightest foldable in the world, more or less. That's pretty interesting in a way. And then again, you get the eye comfort, the high refresh rate, variable refresh rate display on both sides, inside and outside, 8 Plus Gen 1, and it's lighter and it's shaped like a regular smartphone, so you could use the outer display 100% of the time, and if you want to do a lot more, you can sort of pop open the phone. So that's pretty cool in a way. And this phone will go on sale on October 17 in China, and you can pre-order it now pretty much. So but as I said, if you live in the rest of the world, hopefully Honor does bring a global variant of it. It will probably bring it out eventually, because really Honor could compete really well against Samsung in the area sort of foldables, because it's probably one party trick they really have up their sleeves in a way. So it's a pretty cool foldable, and it's not expensive, honestly. Even with a markup, if you decide to import a international spec, which means it will run Google Apps and all from AliExpress, and bring it over to wherever you live and import it from China, it shouldn't be expensive after a markup. Like, should be around $1,100, $1,200, but that's before shipping and stuff like that. So It's pretty good value for money. I really would want to get one if I had the money. So, this and the Techno Phantom Flip, like Techno's made like a folding flip phone. That sounds like a good idea in a way. The Honor though really shines. It has a Snapdragon chip, whereas other affordable sort of sub $1,000 foldables that have sort of come out around that price have instead used MediaTek chips. No problem with MediaTek. I have no beef with them. It's just that they're so slow and they heat a little too much and stutter a bit in when you switch apps and stuff. But you know, Snapdragon processors obviously continue to sort of run without skipping a beat. So that's the thing about it. So the Honor probably has my attention. Really, the VS2 is a pretty good folding phone. I really would want to get one if I probably got a bonus. That is so, yeah. So if you really really want to get a sub $1,000 foldable, you might want to look at the VS2. And if you love foldables, you might want to consider importing because it's a pretty good foldable for the price and also for the specs, pretty good. And again, you wouldn't really be missing out. And it's quite a light phone, so it won't be heavy in the and it'd be easy to sort of fold in and out of. But yeah, on the flip side, get it? On the flip side, Oppo has shown off its newest folding flip phone, the Flip N3 Flip, the Find N3 Flip, sorry, the Find N3 Flip. Try saying that in one word, in one sentence. The N3 Flip from Oppo, they released it in China already. It's sort of shown the folding flip phone in China and have sort of launched it over there. But now it's launching around the world. Next week, Oppo is going to be showing off for the global market generally all over the world the Find N3 series, the main clamshell sort of foldable that is kind of the China variant of the OnePlus Open, and also the Find N3 Flip for the rest of the world. But earlier today, they now shown it. They sort of revealed it for the Indian market, and it's going to cost around $1,000. It's a bit too much money if you think about it, for given the fact that it comes with a Dimensity 9200 chip and triple camera setup, which is decent with Hasselblad processing and features. But yeah, this kind of foldable flip phone should kind of cost around $800, $900. But hey. But also interestingly, it's got one design feature from a OnePlus, and that is a mute switch. That's pretty interesting. So it seems like Oppo and OnePlus are actually sharing resources for once. So that's pretty interesting. But yeah, as I said, next week we're gonna find out more about the Find N3 series generally, and whether the Flip will be the one model that will be coming globally all over the world, and that the main Find N3. Is only going to be available in the Chinese market, so that'll be something to look forward to. And again, kind of something to look forward to, and you know, we'll find out next week. That is. All right, let's move on to OnePlus. And as I've talked about earlier, the OnePlus Open really is going to be the global, you could say, is the doppelganger of the Oppo Find N3, and is sort of the global variant of the Find N3. It's sort of identical inside out, but now OnePlus is going to be doing a launch event this time next week, next Thursday, October 19th, in India, sort of showing off the OnePlus Open, and the event's going to be happening at 7:30 Indian time or 4 o'clock European time. That would be roughly that'll be 6 o'clock Bahrain time. No, I've miscalculated it. 5 o'clock Bahrain time, roughly. We're gonna find out more about OnePlus Open and some of the specs, and you know, the choice of processor and the price also. The price is critical. If they sell this, if OnePlus launches the phone at around $1,000, it'll probably be a good it'll probably be a worthwhile purchase. If it's more than that, more than $1,800, it's probably dead on arrival potentially, but that's just my imagination in a way. While we're at it, with the OnePlus Open, it's gonna be launching officially finally next week. We've gotten more and more leaks about the Open, other than the fact that it's basically the global variant of the Find N3 from Oppo. But the rumor really, or the leaks kind of, we have leaked renders of the phone, and when I say it's kind of like the Find N3, I'm not bluffing here. It also will be coming this kind of faux pas leather back in black, and it has the Hasselblad branding pretty much in a way, and also a matte glass green finish, so that's pretty interesting. I mean, that it says here a glass green, but I'd like to say it's a light green matte finish, because the OnePlus 11 has had a matte finish if I remember correctly. That came out at the start of this year, so that's been a long time, pretty much. But yeah, apparently the OnePlus Open will come with a Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, 16 GB of LPDDR5X RAM, 256 GB of storage, a 7.8-inch inner display, a 6.31-inch outer display, 48-megapixel main, 48-megapixel ultrawide, 64-megapixel 3x optical zoom camera. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And as I said, if you live in Germany, you won't be able to buy this because of a dispute with Nokia and Oppo. And this phone sort of is based off an Oppo, so they won't really be releasing it for the time being. If you're wondering about price now, the OnePlus Open will start at $1,699 in the United States, so about $1,699. So that's about $1,700 roughly before taxes. That's less than the $1,800 price of the Galaxy Z Fold 5 and Pixel Fold. So this could be a solid challenger if all the specs are right and the performance is pretty good and doesn't stutter or lag in any way, shape, or form. This could be a solid competitor to the Pixel Fold and Galaxy Z Fold 5, given that, and also this is the global variant of the Oppo Find N3. So I'd say for American consumers, this is the closest you'll actually get to Oppo, surprisingly. So that's probably a good thing. See, we're probably getting some good out of new phones coming out. You lose some, you get some. That's how it works in life, you know? It's not perfect, you know? You get some, you lose some. It's a give and take. So that's pretty good in a way. But we'll find out more about the Open next week. So hopefully, OnePlus does sort of like open up and offer something worthwhile compared to Samsung. Alright, end of story with foldables. Let's move on and talk about OnePlus generally. It's not been, we're, this year has not really ended, and we're getting new details about the OnePlus 12. Pretty much, Digital Chat Station on Sina Weibo has posted about the OnePlus 12 and some final specs, but it's not about the processor or which processor it'll be using or the display. Really, it's just cameras. So according to him, according to this person, really, the OnePlus 12 will be coming with a 50 megapixel IMX966 OIS, 23 millimeter 1 by 1.4 inch sensor camera with a aperture of f/1.7. The ultra wide camera will be a 48 megapixel 14 millimeter half inch sensor. That's significant. Half inch is pretty big in a way, with an aperture of f/2.2, so that's a lot of clarity right away. Periscope telephoto lens, that'll be a 64 megapixel OV64B OIS sensor, so you'll have optical image stabilization on the main and periscope telephoto camera, so that's pretty cool. Hopefully ultrawide also has OIS, but you wouldn't really need it because, you know, AI will probably process any jitters or stuttering. The periscope lens camera will be 17 millimeter focal length, half inch sensor size, f/2.5 aperture. So that's pretty cool. But pretty much, if we look at it, then you probably get a 3x zoom optical, and probably goes much further in digital. So that's pretty interesting. We don't know about the processor. I'm guessing, if I have to give my best guesstimate, it'll probably be that it'll be coming with the Snapdragon 8 Gen 3, because the 8 Gen 3 will be announced by the end of this year, and the first phones will probably come out starting January. So the OnePlus 12 will be like one of the first phones with the 8 Gen 3. So it's to be expected. It's to be expected. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And there's also more leaks. Digital Chat Station obviously went on to mention that further, that the OnePlus 12 will be coming with a 6.82-inch display, slightly larger, with a resolution of 1440 by 3168, with a peak brightness of, get this, 2600 nits, with with 2160 hertz PWM dimming. So it's a beefy display, whatever OnePlus is putting here. This is no slow display. It's a bit of a beast here. Interestingly, it's going to be manufactured by BOE instead of Samsung, which is kind of noteworthy. That's kind of noteworthy in a way. Another one to add here on top of the all that I've mentioned is that the OnePlus 12 potentially will be coming with a 5400 mAh battery, pretty substantial given its size, and also have 50 watts wireless charging. Finally, a OnePlus with wireless charging, that's kind of rare, more rare than peace in some parts of the world, haha, if you get the reference, you know what I'm talking about. But we're gonna get wireless charging on OnePlus. That's they're not gonna settle for no wireless charging. They're gonna have wireless charging, so that's pretty good in a way. But we'll get to hear more about the OnePlus 12 in December when it happens. So that's pretty cool development in a way. So yeah, so that's pretty substantial, more or less. While we're only on a roll, let's talk about some upcoming phones and the S24. Now, we've kind of been hearing here and there about the S24, and that'll be coming out in January, max. And that'll be coming with better cameras and better processing in a way. But interesting tidbit is that the S24 and S24 Plus will be coming with the Exynos 2400 processor, whereas the S24 Ultra will be coming with the 8 Gen 3. And we've kind of gotten Geekbench scores, surprisingly, in October, mind you. We're only still 3 months away from the phone's release, and we're getting Geekbench scores, which means the phone's sort of ready for production, and it's going to be hitting the factories fairly soon. The S24, in this case, well, one that's using the Exynos 2400, model number SMS926B, scored 6,500 points multi-score on Geekbench, and around 2,067 points single score. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And you're probably wondering about the, and interestingly enough, the Exynos 2400 will have a high performance core that will go all the way up to 3.21 gigahertz. That'll be slightly slower than the 8 Gen 2 that's on the S23, so that's something to keep in mind while we're at it. But if you're wondering about the Snapdragon for the S24 Ultra, on the other hand, that's kind of gotten a much higher score, theoretically. So the 8 Gen 3, potentially, this is not all confirmed, it's not final really, subject to change really. The S24 Ultra, model number SMS928U, scored 2,234 single score in Geekbench, and over 6,800 in multi-core in Geekbench. So that's actually substantially faster than the Exynos 2400 that will be on the regular S24. But I like to believe that the S24 coming with the Exynos chip will probably have will probably mean that the S24 will not increase in price when it does come in launch in January. That is so a pretty interesting development in a way. I mean, can't wait for the S24 series. That'll be coming out in January. And finally, let's talk about Starlink, and specifically a new sort of use of Starlink that has sort of been announced. In case you missed it or you've lived under a rock, Starlink is this kind of satellite internet network that's sort of run by Elon Musk's SpaceX. It's a brilliant product, and it's really changed communications and connectivity around the world in many, many ways beyond most people's imagination, and it's really helped people in so many places, from connecting remote homes and areas to the internet, all the way to even assisting in military operations in the Ukraine war. Apparently, it's helped with communications and sort of, you know, like, I mean, with sort of helped folks on the ground in Ukraine. So that's one example of countless examples. Some folks have actually used the Starlink network to offer sort of in remote areas and places not connected to traditional broadband their own broadband service. What they could do is they could like put in a Starlink dish, then connect it to like a whole black box which has all the networking gear, and you can then offer it be your own ISP and you basically pay Starlink like a ridiculous amount of money to do this, and also offer a free Wi-Fi hotspot if you want it, like, but in the sky. And also, it's also been providing Wi-Fi connectivity to planes, ships, cars, and RVs and the like. And now a new use of Starlink, as I've mentioned, has sort of dropped direct to cell. Pretty much you can now access Starlink using a 4G smartphone. Now, basically how it will sort of work is that with a compatible mobile network, so you have to basically have a SIM of a network. Your SIM card has to be of a network that will support Starlink, pretty much. So it's different from traditional Starlink, where you have to get like a satellite dish that sort of moves in the sky to pick up a perfect signal to connect to the internet, and so on and so forth. The way Starlink direct to cell will work is that if you have an LTE phone, basically a 4G phone, or in the future a 5G phone, and also the phone is connected to a compatible network, so it's basically like roaming. So your phone still will cut to roaming, and the way it sort of works is that the compatible or partner network that Starlink has obviously teamed up with is connected to Starlink's network, and Starlink satellites with a advanced E-Node B modem on board means that you'll be able to connect to the Starlink satellite, and it's kind of like roaming but via satellite. So your phone, you have a compatible SIM card from a network like, say, in the US, T-Mobile. It sort of talks to the Starlink network connects to that phone, sort of talks back and forth, and again, you'll be able to call, text, and access data. So that's pretty interesting. The obvious benefit, it'll eliminate dead zones theoretically, because Starlink's network is very vast and covers huge swathes of the world, and can even cover more parts of the world with regulatory approval in different regions. Now, if you kind of know Starlink, you would probably know that this kind of sort of been announced, because T-Mobile and SpaceX announced a collaboration sort of earlier this year, in the past year or so, where they sort of announced that T-Mobile will allow their customers to connect directly to Starlink, and now the result of this is the direct-to-cell product that Starlink has announced. But also, interestingly, other networks have kind of gotten on board. Various providers from around the world have signed up to offer this functionality. Rogers in Canada, KDDI from Japan, in Australia, Optus, One New Zealand, and Salt from Switzerland will all be offering pretty much direct to cell service when it does launch. And speaking of which, you'll be able to send text messages from next year when it launches completely, and in 2025, that's 2 years from now, you'll be able to make calls and access mobile data, and also connect IoT devices, which is a pretty big selling point for low Earth orbit satellite networks like Starlink and many more, and much more, also with like direct cellular capability, LTE or 5G via satellite, or even 6G directly via satellite. That's the best selling point, really, is that you can connect IoT devices to it, and again, allow folks in remote and dead spot areas to connect and access the internet and make calls. But it's a great selling point for IoT devices, because if you have a grid of sensors, or you have a deployment out in the wild, or you're monitoring something and you want to have data, you want to have two-way data communication, that means the sensors or this grid is sending information, and you can even see what's happening from it directly over the internet. You can do so with this. And also, but then obviously the key part is that these IoT sensors should connect to a 4G network, and on a compatible network, that is. But it's a pretty cool use case, and it, as I said, it would support LTE connected IoT devices, so and also should work if you're on land, lakes, and coastal waters, like small canals. If you're out in the ocean or in the skies, or really, you'll have to get regular Starlink. So that's kind of interesting, and as I said, it's a pretty cool development. It's wonderful to see technology progressing very fast. The fact that probably a decade ago, the idea of direct satellite internet, really, where you just take your phone, you put in the right SIM card and the right settings on your phone, and you can directly connect to a satellite and do a Google search or call somebody or text some, really call somebody, text somebody, even for an extra premium fee or something. If I told somebody a decade ago that you would be doing this, they would call me a lunatic or that I'm on some sort of steroids. But this is reality. This is now, and it's pretty incredible. And also, you're probably wondering, 5G support will be there also down the road in the future. But still, regardless, it's incredible innovation, and it's really this is the kind of innovation that we don't think a lot about. It's not as significant like NFTs or AI, but it's really going to make a big impact in people's lives. And I tell you, it's straight away. It would make a pretty big impact in a lot of people's lives, pretty much. So again, pretty big W from SpaceX, regardless. Alrighty, this leads us to the end of this week's interesting episode. What do you think of everything you've heard today so far? The Honor Magic V2S, VS2, mind you, the Starlink functionality, the new PlayStation 5 Slim. If you have any thoughts about all of the above, do send me an email. The contact information is in the show notes. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave a review on Apple and Spotify. Follow me on social media, on X, Instagram, and TikTok at Sid_Mawun99. Follow me there if you can. And also, you'll be able to hear more from me other than this podcast. Subscribe if you're listening right now. Share this to your friends and family. And yeah, till next week, this is your boy Mawun signing out. Wherever you are, whatever you're up to, have a wonderful weekend. And again, thank you very much for listening. Ciao.